Leadership has been much in the news recently. The marathon leadership contest for the Tory party and a new prime minister. The much swifter transfer of leadership in the royal family. The Queen is dead. Long live the King. Leadership is something that touches everyone's life. All of us choose leaders and reject leaders. That is to say, we allow some people to influence us and not others. Our lives are shaped by different people, even if we don't always think of them as our leaders. In any bookshop, there's lots of books about leadership, how to be a leader, although not so much about how to choose which leaders to follow, which is surely the more important question. Well, 1 Samuel is a book about leadership, although most of it is very different to anything you'd find in a local bookshop. We will witness a massive leadership crisis with a historic change in the nation's leadership. The book takes us back more than 3,000 years. The previous 200 years, ever since Israel came out of the land of Canaan, has been a period of upheaval and insecurity. The nation led by a series of rulers or judges. And the book of Judges ends with this summary. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There was no established, effective leadership. Anarchy reigned, or so it seemed. Life was very far from the life of blessing God had promised before they entered the land. And so 1 Samuel begins, with mention of a certain man, verse 1. We're told his name, Elkanah, and his family background, but it's nothing special, he's just an ordinary bloke. That's where our story begins, and that's where God begins to work. Not with someone famous or powerful, just an ordinary bloke, whose wife is unable to have a child. So it's not just the nation that lacks the blessing of God. So too this woman. And that surely raises the question, does God care? Does he care about Israel's suffering? Does he care about Hannah's distress? Well, Hannah's story unfolds in 4 scenes. Scene 1, verses 3 to 7, is a yearly pattern. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh. So Elkanah was a man who took God seriously. He's a real believer. He gives thanks to God and honours him in a way that was appropriate for his time. And that faithfulness to God was matched by treating his wives well. Verse 4, he gave a share of the sacrifice to Penaiah and her children. And I know verse 5 in this version suggests he shows favour to Hannah, but actually an older translation for verse 5, a better translation I think, reads rather differently. And although he loved Hannah, he would give Hannah only one portion, because the Lord had closed her womb. That's the reason the wife he loved didn't receive any more, because she had no other mouths to feed. He treated both wives well. That phrase, the Lord had closed her womb, is how Elkanah saw things. He didn't understand why his wife was suffering like this, but he did know that their circumstances were given to them by God. And his behaviour towards his wife was shaped by that. He was not resentful towards her. He didn't blame her. He knew that those circumstances had come from the Lord. He loved his wife. And that's how we should see all our circumstances, especially the unwelcome ones. All that comes our way, or doesn't come our way, is God's doing. He is sovereign over all that happens in his world, and he is therefore sovereign over all that happens or does not happen in our lives. That doesn't mean a passive acceptance. Whatever will be. But it does mean a humble recognition of God's hand behind all the circumstances of our lives. And when we see things like that, it'll shape our behaviour, as it did for Elkanah, especially in difficult and unwelcome times. Personally, I've found it a great comfort to know that all the circumstances of my life and those dear to me are in the Lord's hands. It's helped me to respond in a more godly way than I would have done otherwise. Well, Peninnah stands in sharp contrast to Elkanah, verse 6. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. Did you notice exactly the same phrase? Because the Lord had closed her womb. The same phrase is used by Peninnah to be the reason for taunting and provoking her rival. It's not hard to imagine the conversation. What have you got to thank the Lord for, Hannah? It's a bit of a joke you coming here to give thanks to the Lord year after year when he won't give you the one thing you want. The Lord has closed your womb, Hannah. Can't you see? He doesn't care about you. So let's be careful. A correct theological understanding can lead to right behaviour, like Elkanah, or it can be twisted into an excuse for wrong behaviour, like Peninnah. Well, Hannah is so distraught, she would not even eat the portion Elkanah had given her. And that happened year after year. That's scene one. Scene two takes us to one particular year, one of those annual visits. Verse 9, once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. She decides to act, an action which will change not only her life, but the life of her nation. Indeed, if we dare see it, the history of the whole world. She rises from the table, and verse 10, in bitterness of soul, deeply distressed, through the tears, she prayed to the Lord. To know that your suffering comes ultimately from the Lord's hand could lead to fatalism, to resignation. I just have to accept my lot. It could lead to resentment. If God has done this to me, then I don't want anything more to do with him. But neither of those is the response of faith. Faith in God means trusting his sovereignty and his goodness towards us. Faith says, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those called according to his purpose. And that therefore nothing in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Romans chapter 8. Real faith leads us in our troubles not to resignation or resentment, but to prayer, to call out to the God who is sovereign over all things, as Hannah did. The God to whom it's worth praying. Where did Hannah's faith come from? Well, verse 11. And she made a vow, saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son. Hannah is echoing the language of how God had dealt with Israel when he brought them out of Egypt 200 or so years earlier. He had said things like, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people." And that's exactly the language of Hannah. In other words, she's remembering what God has done in the past. She's begging God to do for her what he had done for Israel in the days of Moses. Her faith is not wishful thinking, not cross your fingers and hope for the best. No, it's confidence based on what God has done in the past. That's what real faith is. Trusting God on the basis of his past performance. Now, please don't think Hannah is making some sort of crude bargain with God. Answer my prayer and I'll give him back to you. She knows God is Lord Almighty. And she knows who she is before God, your servant, who humbly makes a request. Hannah's only hope is that God in his goodness would give attention to her sorrow, just as he had listened to the people of Israel in slavery in Egypt. That he would so look upon her misery that he would now do for her what he'd not done before, give her a son. And if he did, she promised that child would be given back to the Lord. The reference to no razor is saying that he would be a permanent Nazarite, someone dedicated to God's mercy, God's service. She's not making demands. She's pleading to God's mercy. Well, Eli the priest completely misunderstands and thinks she is drunk, which raises questions about his competence as a leader. More of that next time. Hannah puts him straight, verses 15-16, and Eli responds as he should have done, verse 17. So Hannah goes away from bringing her request to the Lord, still no child, of course, but a different person, no longer weeping, no longer refusing to eat, no longer sad. In the words of 1 Peter chapter 5, 6 and 7, she has cast all her anxiety on the Lord, knowing that he cared for her. She has humbled herself under God's mighty hand, and he has lifted her up. Scene 3 is very brief, verses 19 and 20. We see the family worshipping the Lord the next morning. I expect Hannah's worship had a rather different tone to it. And we read that Elkanah lay with his wife and the Lord remembered her. Just as God had remembered his covenant with Abraham, so now the Lord remembers Hannah. Whenever the Lord remembers his people, it leads to action on their behalf. It's that sort of remembering. So we won't be surprised if him remembering Hannah will also be him remembering his people, as we'll see in the weeks ahead. And so, verse 20, Hannah gave birth to a son and named him Samuel. There's one final scene, and it takes us back to Shiloh. Hannah chooses not to go until the child is weaned and she's in a position to fulfill her vow, verse 24 onwards. And so the story ends with the boy Samuel worshipping the Lord at Shiloh. The vow fulfilled. So what are we to make of this ancient story? There are a number of possibilities. We might, for example, notice the noble character of Elkanah, honouring the Lord and loving his distressed wife. He's a great example to follow. But this chapter is much more about Hannah than Elkanah. So perhaps we should focus on what Hannah did in her distress. For her, praying was not a formality. It was real. She casts her care on the Lord, knowing that he cared for her. So Hannah's a good example to follow. But I think we should be a bit dissatisfied with both of those. Not that there's anything wrong with what we've said so far. This chapter does provide good examples. But that's not its main purpose. That's not the main meaning of this chapter. We miss so much if we just take the Old Testament characters as examples. And we run into other problems too with that approach. Are we to conclude that if you're sad because you don't have children or indeed any other disappointment, then you should pray earnestly and you'll get what you long for? Is that the message of 1 Samuel? It is where we end up if we simply take Hannah as an example. But that can't be right, for the simple reason that there would have been many other childless women in Israel who no doubt prayed sincerely, yet they were not given a child. In other words, we're told this story about Hannah not because she is typical, but precisely because her story is unusual. Of all the troubled women in Israel, the Lord chose to answer the prayer of this one. So the unusualness of Hannah's story limits how much it can be taken as an example for the rest of us. Why was Hannah's prayer answered? Was it because she prayed so sincerely? No. Was it because she was the most miserable of all childless women? No. Was it because she made such an extravagant vow? Certainly not. Take that example approach to the Old Testament stories too far, and it will mislead us into thinking one of those ideas is biblical, when they are not. This chapter is not primarily about Hannah or Elkanah. It's mainly about God. It shows us that God cared for Hannah. And we will see, as the story unfolds, that his care for Hannah was his care for Israel, for the whole nation. What he did for Hannah will turn out to be for the benefit of all Israel, because this boy Samuel will be part of God's answer to the lack of leadership in Israel. You see, Hannah is part of a bigger story, part of God's unfolding plan. It is, isn't it, a very unexpected starting point for an answer to that leadership crisis? Who else would have begun with a miserable, sobbing Hannah, unable to have children, a rather insignificant Elkanah? We might expect to look amongst the prominent and the powerful to solve a leadership crisis. But these unimpressive beginnings serve to highlight that this is God who is at work. The point of Hannah's story is that God cares. God acts on behalf of his people. It is God who will answer the leadership crisis and do it in a way that makes it clear that it is he who is acting. He cares about the leadership of his people, and so he gives Hannah a son. Just before we finish, let's jump to the end of Hannah's prayer in chapter 2. For much of the prayer, she is rejoicing in the transforming God, the God who turns things upside down. But at the climax of her prayer, the end of verse 10, her words turn to prophecy. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Now, it is remarkable that Hannah should speak of God's king, because at the time there was no king in Israel. Not just God's king, but also his anointed. In Hebrew, the word is Messiah, which in Greek would be the word Christ. Now, I guess Hannah didn't fully realize the significance of these God-given words. But clearly, the birth of her son Samuel, which prompted this prayer, is going to be part of something much, much bigger. Here is the hint of one who will be the answer to the leadership crisis, not just in Israel, but in the whole world. Hannah's son would in time be surpassed by the birth of another son, born to an equally insignificant couple, a birth that would be even more against the normal run of things, the Lord's anointed. God's care for us finds its fullest expression in his provision of that son, Mary's son, Jesus Christ. He is the leader we need. He is the king who cares for us. And this side of the cross, we surely know that far more than Hannah ever knew. And if you belong to him, then you too can learn to cast all your anxieties upon him with even greater confidence than Hannah. Because you and I surely know, with far greater evidence than Hannah, that he cares for you, for me.